Iran's foreign minister says European members of the 2015 nuclear deal must demand an end to U.S. economic terrorism against Tehran. Iraqi media said the two U.S. military convoys have come under attack in the south of the country. And NASA's robotic explorer, the Perseverance, successfully lands on Mars in an ambitious mission to search for ancient life. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, Iran's foreign minister says that three European members of the 2015 nuclear deal must demand an end to U.S. economic terrorism against Tehran. In a tweet, Mohammad Javad Zarif said that Iran's scale-back of nuclear commitments are in response to violations of the accord by the U.S. and three European signatories. In a joint statement on Thursday, the three European countries and the U.S. expressed concern over Iran's remedial measures, and they called on Iran not to go ahead with its decision to ban short-notice inspections by the UN Nuclear Agency. Meanwhile, the U.S. says it will accept an invitation from the European Union to attend a meeting of the signatories to the nuclear deal in an effort to try to revive it. Washington says it is ready to attend a meeting of Iran and other signatories to the nuclear deal. State Department spokesman Ned Price said the U.S. will accept an invitation from the European Union to discuss a diplomatic way forward on the nuclear program. In a tweet, the bloc's political director had proposed an informal meeting of all nuclear deal participants, saying the accord is at a critical juncture. The U.S. also notified U.N. Security Council that the U.N. sanctions on Iran removed as part of the deal remain terminated. Former U.S. administration had sought to reinstate the bans despite widespread opposition. Also on Thursday, the U.S. eased restrictions imposed by Donald Trump's administration on movements of Iranian diplomats in New York. And now joining us for extended conversation on this very subject is Jack Rice, criminal defense attorney and former CIA officer, joining us from Minneapolis, and Einar Tangen, author and columnist, joining us out of Beijing. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. Einar, I'm going to start with you. Your thoughts, Einar. We're seeing a lot of opposition from the Biden administration to the maximum pressure campaign by the Trump administration towards Iran, by the opposition to the fact that Trump, back in May of 2018, opted out of the JCPOA. We're seeing a lot of rhetoric in the respect that the administration wants to move back into the, under the penumbra of the JCPOA somehow. Where's the action? What's the snag?
Well, I mean, right now, both sides are positioning in terms of how they want to negotiate. Obviously, this is you go first type of situation. But I think you should look at the real issue here, for instance, is Wendy Sherman. She was the one who led the 2015 negotiations on the JCPOA from the U.S. side. And she has now been named to be the number two at the State Department, a very clear choice, that the Biden administration is serious. This is nothing surprising. This was an Obama-era initiative that was worked out with Iran, and it is expected, he said he was going to try to return to it. But right now, it's just the who starts first situation.
Right, and Mr. Jack Rice, I'm going to swing over to you now. So what happens? I mean, there are anti-JCPOA elements both inside Iran and outside Iran. Outside of Iran, for obvious reasons, from the Saudis, from Tel Aviv, from a lot of elements in the U.S. and Europe itself, within the country, they feel there isn't the trust isn't there, and because of that, the will is gone to try to go back into the JCPOA. So, really, it's kind of a tough thing to try to revive this thing, and it's getting tougher every day. How do you see it playing out? Oh, Einar, it seems like we don't have a Jack Rice. So okay. I'm going to put that question to you. How do you see it playing out from your own forward?
Let me take a shot at that question. What you see here is there are obviously entrenched forces who do not want to see Iran and the JCPOA resurrected. But, lately you'll note that Biden did not call MBS. He called his father, the king. And that was a clear signal that there's some repudiation and difficulty with the policies that have been followed, the more aggressive policies of the son. He's also made it very clear that, big strategy not only with Iran, but also with China. He wants to work more collaboratively with his, quote, allies, especially in Europe. And this is something that Europe wants to see. You know, obviously there are questions about, short notice inspections and things like this. But I think those can be worked out. The real issue is, how does Biden see the world? And if it is, in fact, trying to gather with his European allies, especially as it pertains to, basically trying to contain China, then that will probably be good for Iran, because this is, as I said, something that Europe is most concerned about.
Thank you. And it seems like we do have Mr. Jack Rice now out of Minneapolis on the line joining us. Hello, Jack. Always a pleasure to have you on, get your perspective on things. I'm going to ask you, Jack, how do you see this thing? I mean, do you see a revival taking place now? Obviously, we're heading to Europe to have a sit down, everyone that's involved in this, all the players. So my question to you, how do you see that meeting taking place? And do you see a revival taking place, your level of optimism here?
I do. When we look at the likes of a President Biden, and I've had multiple conversations with him over the years, he's a multinationalist, is how he sees this. And if you think about the nuclear agreement, you realize that it was the Russians and the Chinese and the Germans and the French and the Brits and the Iranians and the Americans. I mean, this is a multinational effort. That's what it was at its core. You look at the Secretary of State that President Biden chose, Secretary of State Blinken, he's a perfect example of a multinationalist. This was something that was very purposeful, something they've talked about and thought about. Of course, I think there's going to be quite a dance now on how you deal with the lifting of sanctions on the one side, the willingness of the Iranians to actually pull back to either 2019 or even earlier, and what that means for everybody in the room.
And that's the thing, Jack. You just mentioned a bunch of really big hitters, not just with respect to the JCPOA, but on the international arena. So then why aren't we seeing the sense of urgency to get this thing back up and running again?
Well, I think we are seeing something.
We're starting to see it now to some extent, but up until now, why haven't we seen it? Go ahead.
Well, think about it this way. I mean, with President Biden, he just came into office, was it 3 weeks ago, something like that? And if you realize how short of time that is, and he's dealing primarily with a pandemic right now, which is dominating his time, and he's trying to politically balance that piece, which is looking domestically, even though it's an international question, and this issue that's going on with the Iranians, which was fundamental to part of this campaign in the first place. So I think while they're moving, there are still problems. Of course, we realize that the Iranians have a presidential election coming up in 4 months. We also know that the Iranians were talking about denying UN inspections starting on the 21st. So there's a big push on both sides here. And I think there's a whole lot of, as you put it, heavy hitters in the room trying to figure out what to do.
All right, Mr. Einar Tangen, your final thoughts on this, please.
Well, I would agree with Jack. I mean, it's really about the sequencing of how this comes together. There is willingness on all sides. I would add that if you want Russia and China in the room on this, and I think it is necessary, you're in this conundrum where you want to contain these two powers, but the reality is that you have to work with them.
And Jack, one final question to you. Do you see the U.S. at this point making any unreasonable not overtures, but demands, new stipulations to the JCPOA that may lead to its falling apart?
Well, I hope not. I hope not, because I think this is in everybody's interest. I mean, if we think about the pandemic as a whole, what we've just seen is 4 years of unilateralism, the idea that somehow the Americans can do something by themselves. They can't. The world is simply interconnected, and state lines are irrelevant when it comes to this issue. The blowback, if this doesn't happen, reaches far beyond Iran. It's not just what happens in the Middle East, but what this does in the bigger sense of the world. So I think this is something that's bigger than simply the U.S. and Iran. This is something that's bigger for the entire world, and I think everybody needs to come to the table, including the Russians, including the Chinese.
Thank you, gentlemen. It's always a pleasure to have you both on the program. Jack Rice, criminal defense attorney and former CIA officer, joining us from Minneapolis, and Einar Tangen, author and columnist, joining us from Beijing. And now two U.S.-led coalition convoys have reportedly come under attack in the south of Iraq. Iraqi media said a convoy was targeted by anti-tank guided missiles on an expressway in the province of Basra, There's been no report of casualties as of yet, but hours later after that, a second attack took place on another U.S. logistics convoy reportedly in the Agassiz province. U.S. forces and their supply convoys have increasingly come under attack in Iraq amid growing anti-American sentiments following the U.S. assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis last January. Iraqi parliament passed a resolution calling on the government to end the presence of U.S. forces in the country. The onslaught of the pandemic and ensuing national lockdowns have lifted the lid off an ugly truth about the UK. 14 million Britons, a third of them children, now live below the breadline, a poverty crisis which is tarnishing the image of one of the most powerful economies on the planet.
This winter has seen food bank queues snaking around corners in the UK. Those down on their luck waiting up to 5 hours in the freezing cold, not knowing if there will be anything left for them. In places where poverty and hunger were already rife, it's the tip of the iceberg. This is Jaywick, a seaside village in southeast England, named the country's most deprived area for the past decade. Over the years, local authorities have been grilled over worsening conditions here to no avail. The council declined our request for an interview, but on Facebook, residents themselves were forthcoming. Maria responded to my post, saying her family and neighbours needed food. People here resent their Jaywick's shantytown status and are wary of outsiders. Reporters have tried to get interviews by offering them alcohol in the past. Drug and alcohol abuse are already a problem here. The government has given the local council millions of pounds to build a marketplace and affordable housing, but the locals say they're yet to feel the benefit of that.
They sort the landlords out and they do better housing for people in Jaywick. I know they've built some new houses, but the trouble is the residents of Jaywick are not being offered the new housing.
They're not.
So it is, they're not clearing the crisis really, because there's a lot of people struggling in places with no heating and poor decorating.
These cottages used to be temporary holiday accommodation, but have served as permanent homes for decades now. They are run down and have little or no heating. There is no pressure on property owners to fix them either. Brenda has lived here for 31 years, and with her husband suffering from Alzheimer's, the food bank closing has only added to her woes. Supermarkets say they can't deliver to Jaywick. People are relying on community spirit to get them through. Half the children here live in poverty. Unemployment is high. For every five people, there's only one job. The British government stands accused of leaving it to charities to feed the country's hungry, millions of them children. NGOs say this is a comedown for the fifth largest economy in the world, and food bank queues growing because of the pandemic has only highlighted an already existing crisis. Bianca Rahimi, London.
A new poll indicates a legacy of the 2020 election in the U.S. may be a rejection of the two mainstream political parties. For the first time ever, a top pollster found that half the country now identifies as an independent, while support for a third party is also at a record high. Rami Mazahari reports from Chicago.
Following the bitterly disputed 2020 election campaign, top pollster Gallup has found that support for third parties is at its highest point ever in the United States. 62% of people agree that a third party is needed because Democrats and Republicans, quote, do such a poor job representing the American people. Another polling record was also recorded. The number of Americans who identify as an independent is now at 50%.
And everybody's tired of it. Everybody is fed up with the hypocrisy and ineffectiveness of the Democrats in the terms that they claim to want to be effective. I think they're actually very effective in what they're actually doing. And the Republicans, of course, you know, they have one program, which is tax cuts for the rich.
Ex-President Donald Trump, who remains banned from top U.S. social media, issued a rare statement which attacked top Republican leadership. That's being interpreted as a sign that he may stay within the mainstream and try to make so-called Trumpism the undisputed platform of the Republican Party. However, there is much speculation that Trump will start a new third party. Polls say a Trump-led third party would attract not just two-thirds of Republicans, but also 30% of independents and even 15% of Democrats. The party would push Republicans into third place, ushering in a new era of multi-party plurality and ending what is probably the world's oldest political duopoly.
Certainly those people are out there ready for the picking for a third party that they perceive as A, fighting for things that are important to their daily lives, and B, treating them with respect and not treating them as, you know, you're all racist and fascist and you know, sexist and whatever.
Trump won in 2016 by running as a so-called outsider candidate, and while he is unemployed 4 years later, rejection of the two mainstream parties is now the majority sentiment. The most popular third parties currently in the U.S. are the Libertarians, who are associated with a strong demand for individualism, the Greens, the Party for Socialism and Liberation, and the Alliance Party, a coalition for independence. Those parties combined for under 2% of the 2020 presidential vote. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The Israeli regime has allowed a small shipment of Sputnik V vaccines to reach the Gaza Strip after coming under heavy pressure by a human rights organization. Now, Tel Aviv has kept the impoverished enclave under a tight blockade since 2007, hampering efforts by local authorities to fight this deadly coronavirus pandemic. Ashraf Shannon reports.
A small shipment of the coronavirus vaccine has finally made it to the Gaza Strip after long delays by the Israeli regime. On Wednesday, the first batch of the Russian Sputnik V vaccines was received by the Ministry of Health in the Gaza Strip. The blockaded enclave has registered close to 54,000 coronavirus infections, mostly since late August 2020. The Israeli regime allowed the entry of the vaccines after coming under heavy criticism by human rights organizations.
Israel, as an occupying power of Palestinian land, bears full responsibility for providing all medical supplies, including inoculations, to combat the coronavirus. We call on all international organizations, including Amnesty International and the World Health Organization, to continue their pressure on Israel to abide by international laws and norms.
Under the Fourth Geneva Convention, the Israeli regime must ensure medical supplies to Palestinians, including combating the spread of pandemics. The enclave's health sector has been battered by the Israeli blockade and multiple wars.
Finally, and after a long delay, the Israeli occupation allowed the transfer of vaccines to the 2 million Palestinians in Gaza. And I think that came as a result of an intervention from UN agencies like WHO and human rights groups.
Despite the increasing number of coronavirus infections in the Gaza Strip, the Israeli regime continues to place tight restrictions on the entry of humanitarian supplies, including medical equipment.
We have been campaigning on all levels, especially on international agencies, to pressure Israel, who is an occupying power, to bear its legal responsibilities. We have made partial success with the entry of a small shipment of vaccines. We will continue to campaign and expose Israel's actions that have led to the deterioration of the health sector in Gaza, especially during the coronavirus pandemic.
Experts maintain that the Israeli blockade must be fully lifted to help avert a humanitarian disaster.
Human rights groups say Israel's illegal practices have compounded the risk of coronavirus infection for nearly 2 million Palestinians, making it extremely difficult to combat the pandemic. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Frigid temperatures grip parts of the United States that are unaccustomed to a deep freeze as officials demanded an investigation into widespread power outages. At least 23 people died in the storm or its aftermath. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Michael Levinson, Derek Bryson Taylor, David Montgomery, and Campbell Robertson. The piece is titled, Millions Without Power from Sprawling Winter Storm. Stay with us. Come on. Frigid temperatures grip parts of the United States that are unaccustomed to a deep freeze as officials demanded an investigation into widespread power outages. At least 23 people died in the storm or its aftermath. Millions of people remained without power on Tuesday, 16th of February, and were anticipating another cold, dark night in the wake of a deadly winter storm that bulldozed its way across the southern and central parts of the United States this week. In places where such perilously frigid conditions tend to arrive just once in a generation. By late afternoon on Tuesday, 16th of February 2021, the storm was moving into eastern Canada, but the damage left behind was severe. Temperatures across the middle of the country had plummeted to lows not felt in a century or even more, with measurements of minus 14 degrees Fahrenheit in Oklahoma City and minus 20 in Fayetteville, Arkansas, even as a new winter storm was building in the southern plains. At least 23 people have died since winter weather began wreaking havoc last week, some from the cold itself and some from attempts to escape it. And almost 4 million customers across the country remained without electricity on Tuesday evening, 16th of February, according to PowerOutage.us, which aggregates live power data from utilities. More than 3.5 million of those outages were in Texas, where many people had been without power for hours or even days in freezing temperatures. Texas leaders, including Texas Governor Greg Abbott, expressed sharp criticism of the operation of the state's power grid, and the Texas House Speaker announced a legislative hearing looking into the widespread power outages. The disruptions caused problems at water treatment plants, leading to boil water advisories for hundreds of thousands of people across Texas, from Fort Worth down to Rio Grande Valley. Some customers lost water altogether, forced to flush their toilets with melting snow. By early Tuesday afternoon, Southwest Power Pool, which manages the electrical grid across 17 central and western states, had stopped ordering controlled rolling cutoffs of power service to customers as the energy supply began meeting the extreme demand, a spokesman said. The storm also severely disrupted the distribution of the coronavirus vaccine, forcing vaccination sites to close down across southern United States and hampering the shipments of vaccine doses. The brutal cold in the middle of the country seemed to defy a trend of ever milder winters, but the frigid temperatures in Texas could be a consequence of global warming. There is research suggesting that the Arctic warming is weakening the jet stream, the high-level air current that circles the northern latitudes and usually holds back the frigid polar vortex. The death toll related to the storm that swept across the southern and central United States this week, accompanied by record-breaking cold temperatures, continued to rise on Tuesday, 16th of February 2021. In Houston, Texas, a woman and a girl died from carbon monoxide poisoning after a car was left running in a garage to generate heat, according to Houston police. A homeless man was also found dead at an overpass. And a man who was found dead on a median in Midtown Houston on Monday was suspected to have died from the extreme cold, the Harris County Sheriff said. A grandmother and three children were killed in a house fire in Sugar Land, Texas, early on Tuesday, 16th of February, in a neighborhood that was without power, according to local news outlets. In southern Louisiana, a man died after slipping on ice and hitting his head, officials said. And a 10-year-old boy died in Tennessee after falling into an icy pond. The authorities in San Antonio, Texas, said that weather conditions contributed to the death of a 78-year-old man. Slippery roads were responsible for 10 deaths in Kentucky and Texas, including a pileup in Fort Worth that involved more than 100 vehicles and killed 6 people. In Missouri, a 59-year-old man was killed when a snowplow collided with his pickup truck on Monday afternoon, 15th of February. A person who got out of a vehicle after a car crash in Houston, Texas late on Monday was struck and killed. The weather-driven destruction this week did not come solely from ice and snow. In coastal North Carolina, a tornado killed 3 people and injured at least 10 others early on Tuesday morning, 16th of February, though it was unclear if it was meteorologically related to the winter storm. 2 Houston emergency rooms treated about 100 cases of carbon monoxide poisoning over a 16-hour period from Monday to Tuesday, 15th and 16th of February. A huge spike, a hospital spokeswoman said, as residents of the city shivering without power resorted to dangerous methods of keeping themselves warm. Doctors said they were concerned about running out of treatment options if the rush of patients with carbon monoxide poisoning continued. People with severe cases of carbon monoxide poisoning must be placed into a hyperbaric chamber to receive oxygen. The Houston emergency rooms only have a handful available. It's definitely very alarming, said Dr. Salil Bandari, an emergency medicine physician affiliated with the Memorial Hermann Hospital at a Texas medical center. Dr. Bandari and medical staff treated 57 patients late on Monday and early on Tuesday, half of them children, he said. 25 of those patients needed to spend time in the hyperbaric chamber, Dr. Bandari said, and it can only treat 6 people at a time. The hospital typically treats about 75 to 100 cases of carbon monoxide poisoning during an entire year, according to a hospital spokeswoman. Meanwhile, as millions of Texans endured their second day of power blackouts caused by a devastating winter storm, Texas Governor Greg Abbott called for an emergency reform of the Electric Reliability Council of Texas, known as ERCOT, saying the operator of the state's power grid has been anything but reliable over the past 48 hours. Greg Abbott designated his call for an investigation and reform of ERCOT as an emergency item in the current Texas legislative session, putting it on a fast track towards enactment. The announcement came just after the Texas House Speaker, Dade Phelan, ordered a 25th of February Joint Committee hearing to investigate ERCOT and determine what caused the lights to go off across the Lone Star State. Both the governor and the House Speaker said their goal is to ensure that the conditions never reoccur. The sharply worded response from 2 of the state's top political leaders came amid a fierce public backlash after millions of Texans were left without power following a storm packing record snow and single-digit temperatures late on Sunday and Monday, 14th and 15th of February. Far too many Texans are without power and heat for their homes as Our state faces freezing temperatures and severe winter weather, the governor said, and this is unacceptable. As the operator of the state's power grid, ERCOT has faced high demands for electricity throughout the storm and imposed blackouts to distribute the power burden across the overloaded system. Hundreds of thousands of Texans have gone without power and electricity for hours at a time, and in many cases well over a day. Bill Magnus, ERCOT's president and chief executive, said in an interview on Austin's KXAN-TV on Tuesday that the council was trying to get people's power back on as quickly as possible, but at the same time needed to safely manage the balance of supply and demand on the grid to avoid larger collapses in the power system. As hard as these power outages are, he said, they avoid a much more catastrophic situation. At the national level, though, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and the North American Electric Reliability Corporation said on Tuesday they would jointly investigate the blackouts and electric grid failures in Midwestern and Southern United States.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
I saw Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jinan, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to continue, and I'm back now again, and I do wish to try to finish off sharing some important points that is valuable for all of us to learn about here in this book. We were talking about some of the common courtesies, some of the etiquettes, hygienic, public, things that we need to observe, not only for ourselves on a personal level, but also things that we need to observe as far as us representing ourselves in front of others. Well, on the topic of mental health, and we did say that mental health is divided into two parts, al-aql, intellect, and al-qalb, the heart. Let me read the hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam. And he's talking about having a healthy body. And then he says, وَأَفْضَلُ مِنْ صَحَّةِ الْبَدَنِ تَقْوَى الْقَلْبِ. And better than having a healthy body is having a pious heart. Another hadith, لَا وَجَعَ أَوْجَعُ لِلْقَلْبِ مِنَ الْذُنُوبِ. There's nothing that will hurt the heart more than sin. Another hadith, أَلَا وَإِنَّ مِنْ صَحَّةِ الْبَدَنِ تَقْوَى الْقَلْبِ. One of the important elements of having a healthy body is the piety of the heart, تَقْوَى الْقَلْبِ, that your heart is wary of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Another hadith, فَإِنَّ تَقْوَى اللَّهِ شِفَاءُ مَرَضِي أجسامكم. This is in Nahj al-Balagha, Imam Ali alayhi salam. He says that one of the means of taqwa Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is in it resulting in curing sicknesses of your body. Now, there are many effects that a healthy heart produces, and when we're talking about here, when we're talking about a healthy heart, we're talking about the spiritual side of a healthy heart. And in the verses of the Holy Quran, and also in the ahadith and riwayat of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, they kind of bring both of them together. And an example for this, let me read to you what it says as far as, you know, that heart is concerned. You know that in the Holy Quran, the word qasat qulubuhum has been used frequently. So this qaswatul qalb or qasawatul qalb, having a hard heart, you know, in Farsi they say sang dil, which means having a heart of stone, pretty much means that there's that fragility of the heart, that sympathizing kind of heart that is vibrant with remembrance of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in it being activated through, you know, spiritual awareness and connection and feelings, positive feelings. All of that is eliminated and disappears when a person has a darkened heart, has a black heart.
Ayatollah Javadi Amoli, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
And the main factor that leads to a hardened heart is, of course, without doubt, as we know, sin. Now, that's why in the Quran it's referred to in different ways. The heart in the negative side is referred to as being hardened, as having been qaswa, having being hardened, as blinded, as being a blind heart, and also as being rusted, dirty. Kalla bal rana ala qulubihim. You know, that rain is, of course, something that has been mentioned in the Holy Quran. Now, what are the things that lead to having a hardened heart? Just before I mention that, I'd like to mention a very interesting hadith from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam that's also mentioned here, where he says, "La ilm katalab al-salama." There is no knowledge better than seeking health. You know, these are for those people who are very much into health. That's a very, very interesting area in Islam. La ilm katalab al-salama. There is no knowledge better than seeking health. Or there's no knowledge equal to that of seeking health. وَلَا سَلَامَ And there is no health better or equal than سَلَامَةُ الْقَلْبِ Than having a healthy heart. And that's all to do with, you know, الْقَلْبُ السَّلِيمِ A pure heart. It's all to do with avoiding going down that path of a dark black heart. يَوْمَ لَا يَنْفَعُ مَالٌ وَلَا بَنُونَ إِلَّا مَنْ أَتَى اللَّهَ بِقَلْبٍ سَلِيمٍ الْقَلْبُ السَّلِيمِ is ultimately the objective and the goal that we want to have. And that's why, you know, one of the things that we need to always remember, Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he said, يَا أَبَا ذَرَ He said to Abu Dhar, O Abu Dhar, إِنَّ اللَّهَ تَبَارَكَ وَتَعَالَى Almighty God, La yanzuru ila suwarikum. God doesn't look at the way you look, your images, your form. Wala ila amwalikum. And He doesn't look at your wealth, He doesn't look at your money. But God, walakin yanzuru ila qulubikum wa a'malikum. But God will look at your hearts and at your deeds. Inshallah, we will continue on in our next episode. Walhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahireen.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children scream.
There was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind, a momentary emotion. Space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart. There will always be there, be there.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In recent years, Tunisia had experienced significant economic problems. The country's economy shrank almost 9% in 2020, the largest contraction since its independence in 1953. The official rate of unemployment in Tunisia is 16%. Unemployment in the age group of 15 to 25 is over 36%. The International Monetary Fund, IMF's extended fund facility, imposed several austerity measures, causing the depreciation of the Tunisian dinar in 2017. and consequent inflation has impoverished the popular classes and sharply increased unemployment levels. We now present you an article written by Yanis Iqbal, an independent researcher and freelance writer based in Aligarh, India. The piece is titled "The Revolution Continues in Tunisia." Please stay with us for more of Yanis Iqbal's article. Protests have been occurring in Tunisia since mid-January 2021. On 26th of January 2021, hundreds of Tunisians had marched from the Essaouen in Tunis to the Parliament building in Bardo, calling for the overthrow of the system and development, jobs, freedom and dignity. As the crowd swelled, the protests became one of the largest this year. The police used barricades, water cannons and violence to stop them from reaching the parliament building. The march to the Tunisian parliament was called after the death of a protester in Spetla a day before. The protester, identified as Haykal al-Rashdi, was injured by a tear gas canister fired by police officers during an earlier demonstration. The call for the protest was given by several parties, including the Workers' Party, the Democratic Current, At-Tayyar, the United Democratic Patriotic Party, and the Al-Shaab movement. According to recent estimates by Lawyers Without Frontiers Association, since the beginning of the nightly clashes, more than 1,600 people have been arrested in Tunisia, including activists. Around 600 of those are minors and children. About 23,000 people in Tunisia are currently in jail. These numbers have not decreased over the years. The first round of protests on 14th of January 2021 coincided with the 10th anniversary of the fall of President Ben Ali's regime. Ben Ali's removal from power was the outcome of an intense struggle courageously waged by the Tunisian masses. On 17th of December 2010, Mohamed Bouazizi, a Tunisian street vendor, set himself on fire following yet another instance of harassment and humiliation at the hands of local police and municipal officials. Within hours of Bouazizi's self-immolation, protests began erupting across the town, rapidly gathering pace and spreading towards other urban centres in Tunisia. Mohamed Bouazizi's death was long and agonising. When he finally died on 4th of January 2011, the conflagration sparked by his act roared into the national capital, Tunis. In a matter of days, President Ben Ali was forced into exile. The Tunisian people did not only oppose the political authoritarianism of the Ben Ali administration, but also the neoliberal policies under his rule, which created massive inequality, unemployment and widespread misery in the country. The ruling class has completely ignored the latter dimension, choosing to impose further neoliberalism in the aftermath of the Tunisian revolution. Results have been the same: sustained agitations. In 2015, the protests of the unemployed went from the western Kasserine province to the main avenues of Tunis, the capital, the mining area of Gafsa and Sidi Bouzid, the town that started the Islamic Awakening movement. What we're seeing today is the people's desire to complete the revolution that they started back in 2010. In recent years, Tunisia has experienced significant economic problems. The country's economy shrank almost 9% in 2020, the largest contraction since its independence in 1953. The official rate of unemployment in Tunisia is 16%, However, the majority of those employed are in seasonal or temporary jobs. Unemployment in the age group of 15 to 25 is over 36%. The International Monetary Fund, IMF's extended fund facility, imposed several austerity measures, causing the depreciation of the Tunisian dinar in 2017. And consequent inflation has impoverished the popular classes and sharply increased unemployment levels. The lack of income and employment opportunities has led to the largest exodus of Tunisians from the country in recent years. Tunisians made up the largest number of irregular migrants, over 12,000 in fact, who arrived in Italy in 2020 on boats crossing the Mediterranean Sea, five times more than the previous year. Tunisian migrants risk their lives crossing the Mediterranean Sea, and if they survive that, they face the European Union's brutal border regime and racist discrimination in European countries. Tunisia has a deficit estimated at 11.5% of gross domestic product or GDP in 2020 and public debt at 90% of gross domestic product or GDP. Consequently, the country will issue debt worth up to $3 billion in 2021. Of this, $3 billion, $2.3 billion is expected to come from the International Monetary Fund or IMF. This loan package has its own program of reforms, consisting of cuts to high public wage bill, reduction of subsidies, and privatization of some state-owned companies. In sum, the International Monetary Fund will push for unabated austerity, even as protesters decry the insensitive language of deficit control. What the International Monetary Fund is doing is not new. It was involved in two loan agreements in 2013 and 2016, whose conditionality imposed wage freezes, tax increases, and spending cuts in Tunisia. On average, governments in Tunisia have not lasted for more than a year since 2011, and three have succeeded each other in quick succession in 2020 alone. Political instability has been the norm from the very start of the Tunisian revolution. Following Ben Ali's departure for Saudi Arabia in the winter of 2011, and the interlude that followed, it was Ennahda that would become the leading party within the first two coalition governments voted in by Tunisia's electorate. The first of these governments was led by Hamadi Jebeli, lasting from December of 2011 to March of 2013. On 19th of February 2013, Jebeli resigned following the growing discontent of the workers and youth against austerity measures, the rising cost of living, regional inequalities, growing unemployment, taxes, and escalating political violence. The second government was directed by Ali Larayev and held power from March 2013 until January of 2014. The latter's mandate collapsed when the combination of persistent social turmoil and the assassination of two prominent leftist politicians forced the resignation of his government. The Larayev government agreed to hand over power to a caretaker government of technocrats led by Mahdi Juma in early 2014. A new constitution was introduced on 26th of January 2014, which eliminated the references to Islamic law whilst recognizing Islam as the religion of Tunisia. The constitution-making process occurred against a hypocritical background. The interim government, under the direction of the International Monetary Fund, kept increasing household electricity and gas prices, as well as fuel prices and taxes that would affect taxi drivers and farmers. Tired by the neoliberal orientation embraced by the political forces, the Tunisian people have got disillusioned with the post-2011 political arena, trying to find alternative viewpoints. In 2013, public opinion data revealed the following. 74.5% of the Tunisian people expressed little or no confidence in the government. 89.6% expressed little or no confidence in political parties. And 83.4% expressed little or no confidence in the Tunisian parliament. Some 44.1% of the Tunisian people strongly agreed that the government should take more responsibility to ensure that everyone is provided for. A significant majority backed that same position, and only 3.5% of respondents aligned themselves with a position that people should take more responsibility to provide for themselves. Some 90% of Tunisians strongly agreed that government should constitutionally guarantee social protection and healthcare services to the poor. As much as 30% of Tunisians agreed that taxing the rich to subsidize the poor constitutes an essential characteristic of democracy, with an additional 36.5% skewed towards the agree poll and only 9.9% expressing strong disagreement. About 40.2% of those agreed that state aid for unemployed people is an essential characteristic of democracy, with an additional 35.1% skewing towards that poll and only 4.5% expressing strong disagreement. Some 22.1% agreed that income redistribution is an essential characteristic of democracy. Tunisia has again become a powder keg of economic and political grievances. These grievances are manifesting themselves in protests. Between 1st of January and 22nd of March 2018, data gathered by the Armed Conflict Location and Event Project shows that Tunisia witnessed 207 separate protests. This followed an especially contentious 2017, during which 678 different protests and riots were recorded across the country. In response to the current protests, Prime Minister Meshishi has reshuffled the cabinet and named 11 new ministers, four of whom are being investigated or suspected of corruption. Tunisians are craving for real change. Changing the figureheads will not work. As long as the rulers fail to realize this, the oppressed masses of Tunisia will continue to struggle for justice.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.